circumstances. You made a decision based on your understanding of what hospitality means, saying yes rather than no. Lisbeth leans in. Next year, I want you to be our front desk manager. Edie perks up. You do? She says. What about Alessandra? Lisbeth shakes her head. I doubt she'll come back next year. But if she does, she'll just have to deal. The hotel feels empty in the aftermath of the Marsh's departure, and Edie has to remind herself that they still have a full hotel. She calls Magda to let her know that Suite 114 has checked out and is ready for a deep clean. Fortunately, they built in a buffer night. No one will check into that room until Saturday. Just then, Mr. Iannucci from room 307 steps in from the family pool in just his bathing suit with a hydrangea blue towel draped over his shoulders like a cape. He lifts his sunglasses to the top of his head. I hate to bother you, he says. Edie would beg to differ on this point. Mr. Iannucci seems to relish being high maintenance. Edie was the one who made the reservation with his secretary right after the ghost story broke. The secretary begged for a two-night stay when Lisbeth had instituted a three-night minimum due to high demand. Fine, Edie granted a two-night stay. Yesterday, he asked for a reservation at the bar at American Seasons less than an hour before he wanted to dine. Who does that? But Edie handled it. This morning, he showed up in the lobby in his pajama bottoms and a Hanes undershirt and typed on his laptop and drank coffee and ate two of Beatrice's almond croissants, even though a sign encouraged the guests to take only one. He then asked Edie if she could arrange for a surfing lesson for later that morning, and Edie smiled and said, I'll try, though what she meant was, a little notice would have been nice. However, Zeke was still friends with everyone at the surf school, so he arranged for a private lesson with Liam, the best instructor. Fine, great. Mr. Iannucci was so happy. Not happy enough to tip either Edie or Zeke, but that's not why they do the job. Then Mr. Iannucci called down to the desk to say that the water temperature on the South Shore was only 72 degrees. That's a bit chilly for me, he said. I'm going to stick to the pool. Edie called to cancel the surfing lesson with her apologies, but feared that the next time she asked for a last-minute favor, she would be turned down. What can I do for you, Mr. Iannucci? Edie says now. The nice lady from the kitchen brought out the lemonade and the cookies, he says. Edie's eyes widen. Lemonade and cookies? Is it 3 o'clock already? But the children at the pool snatched up the cookies before I could even get out of my chaise. Could I possibly get some more cookies? Edie will have to request another special favor, this time from Beatrice. No problem. I'll ask the kitchen for another batch right away. Mr. Iannucci holds up prayer hands, but does he actually say thank you? He does not. He slips back through the pool door. Edie calls the kitchen to ask for more cookies, and when she hangs up, Lisbeth steps out of her office. I'm going home early, Edie. This whole thing with Xavier and the Marshes leaving, I'm schlumped. I need to recharge my batteries for tomorrow. Tomorrow is the last Friday of the month, which means a new Hotel Confidential Instagram post. No problem, Edie says. I've got things covered here. Lisbeth's brow wrinkles. Where's Alessandra? At lunch, Edie says breezily, as if Alessandra hasn't been gone for over 2 hours. A few minutes later, Beatrice appears with another platter of cookies. She shakes her head at Edie in mock disgust. Asking for extra cookies is no bueno because Beatrice is prepping for evening service at the Blue Bar, and Edie says, you're going to make one guest in particular very happy. It better be Shelley Carpenter, Beatrice says, and Edie laughs. But when she steps out onto the patio of the family pool and sees Mr. Iannucci under an umbrella with his laptop out, she thinks, is Mr. Iannucci actually Shelley Carpenter? He has asked for a lot of special favors, starting with the two-night stay, which means he'll be checking out by 11 a.m. the following day, conveniently 1 hour before the post comes out. Here you go, Mr. Iannucci, Edie says, offering him the cookies. She's so hungry she could eat the entire platter herself. The fresh-from-the-oven cookies are studded with milk chocolate chips, white chocolate chips, and toffee bits. They're crisp at the edges but soft in the center. "What service?" Mr. Iannucci says, helping himself to two. Again, not quite a thank you, Edie thinks. She wants to peek at whatever Mr. Iannucci is writing on his laptop. Is Shelley Carpenter really Bob Iannucci, a man? Oh, Edie hopes not. That would be such a disappointment. Edie steps back into the lobby to see a woman heading for the front desk like a blonde bullet. She looks at Edie, then at Alessandra's unmanned computer. "Where is she?" the woman hisses. "I'm sorry?" Edie says. "Where is who?" Though Edie fears she knows. "The little Jolene," the woman says. "Jolene?" Edie thinks. And she relaxes a bit. She thought the woman was looking for Alessandra. "Her!" the blonde says, holding up her phone. She starts scrolling through photos. Alessandra in someone's kitchen, Alessandra on a bathroom scale, Alessandra lying across a very nice king-size bed that Edie suspects is not her bed at Adam and Raoul's house. "She sent these to my husband and told him she'd forward them to me if he didn't pay her $50,000. Despite her empty stomach, Edie feels like she might vomit. "She's blackmailing him," the woman says. "Where is she?" "At lunch," Edie whispers. What's that saying? It takes a thief to catch a thief. Alessandra is a blackmailer just like Grayton. She's a hypocrite. She had sex with this woman's husband and took pictures of herself in their home. They aren't nudes, thank God. It's now 3:15. Alessandra left for lunch 2.5 hours ago. Of course, Alessandra would make an exit right before she had to face the music. "Let me call her cell," Edie says. "What's your name?" "Heidi Bick. She knows who I am." Edie dials Alessandra's number, her eyes stinging with tears. She and Alessandra became friends. They bonded. Not only because Alessandra stood up to Grayton and got Edie's money back, but also because Alessandra is smart and funny, and she's the only person who understands the ins and outs of Edie's days. Grayton told Edie she gave people too much credit, and that's something Edie now cherishes about herself. But she was wrong this time. So, so wrong. The call goes to voicemail. Edie looks at Heidi Bick in frustration. She's not answering. "She slept with my husband," Heidi says. "She lived in my house." Edie closes her eyes. She thinks about how, in nature, insects and reptiles that are brightly colored or flagrantly marked are the most venomous. Alessandra had all the signs, the attention-grabbing hair, the eye crystals, the upside-down name tag. She lured in vulnerable people, trapped them, exploited them. "And then," Heidi says, "the tour de force. She robbed my neighbor Lyric and planted her things in my house, so I would think Michael was having an affair with Lyric." "Good God," Edie thinks. Heidi narrows her eyes. "It was so damn clever that if I weren't appalled, I might be impressed." She reels back. "But I'm appalled. She's a despicable human being." Heidi holds up the phone. "This is blackmail. $50,000? It's extortion. I'm pressing charges." The door to the family pool opens and Mr. Iannucci steps in.
"Pressing charges?" he says. "Sounds like things are getting hot in here."
Edie whips out her fake smile like a gun from a holster. "Can I help you, Mr. Iannucci?"
"Seems I've lost my room key," he says. "Can you make me another?"
"Please," Edie thinks. "You mean, can you please make me another?"
"Happy to," she says in her fake cheerful voice. Mr. Iannucci won't know it's fake, but Alessandra would, because it's a desk thing. Edie doesn't want to be angry at Alessandra. She doesn't want the accusations to be true. She burgled the neighbor's house and planted the neighbor's belongings. Edie turns to the back counter to make Mr. Iannucci a new key for room 307 and sees a manila envelope with Edie scrawled across the front in Alessandra's handwriting. Suddenly, Edie feels like she's living in a Nancy Drew mystery. Where did this come from? It's obviously been there since Alessandra went to lunch and Edie hasn't noticed it, though Alessandra knew Edie would notice it eventually. Does this mean Alessandra isn't coming back from lunch at all? Edie is crushed by the thought. She wonders how she can feel so angry and simultaneously so dejected. Edie hands Mr. Iannucci his keycard, and only once he has slapped off in his flip-flops, again without a thank you, does Edie turn back to Heidi Bick. Alessandra is gone for the day. You're covering for her. I'm not covering for her, believe me, Edie says. I think what she did is appalling, ghastly. She tries to come up with some other strong SAT words. Odious. I'll make sure she contacts you to apologize. I don't want her to contact me, Heidi says. I didn't come here for a big dramatic Real Housewives moment. I sent her a text saying I knew what she'd done and that I was calling the police. Heidi slips her phone into her bag. Then I decided the texting was cowardly, so I came down here. And the closer I got, the more pissed off I became. Heidi takes a breath and looks at Edie with imploring eyes. Listen, I realize half of this mess is my husband's fault. I just want her to leave my family alone. I understand, Edie says. I'll give her that message. Heidi Bick reaches across the desk and grasps Edie's wrist. Thank you. Lisbeth has a real treasure in you. I didn't realize you knew Lisbeth, Edie says. The plot thickens. We're friends, Heidi says. I considered calling her first and getting the little Jolene fired, but Lisbeth has enough going on and it's hard to find help, and I'm determined to fight my own battles. Edie's spirit flags with, it's hard to find help, because as incensed as Edie is, she doesn't want to see Alessandra fired. What will they do if Alessandra doesn't come back? The quick fix would be to put Edie's mother, Love, on the day desk, and sorry, but that's not an option. And yet, how will Edie ever be able to express her opposition to this arrangement to either Lisbeth or her mother? I understand. Heidi backs up toward the door. Tell her to go ruin someone else's life. The instant Heidi Bick disappears, Edie rips open the envelope. Inside is a note. Edie, I'm sorry. This is rightfully yours. And a stack of $100 bills. Edie counts it. $4,000. Alessandra's bonuses. As soon as Edie's shift is over and Richie shows up, he wants to talk about how nice Edie and Love's home is and how grateful, yada yada, but Edie cuts him off. She doesn't have time. She hops on one of the hotel bikes and books it over to Hooper Farm Road, where Adam, Raoul, and Alessandra live. Edie rehearses what she's going to say in her head. She's going to air her anger first. How could you? You're a hypocrite. I believed in you. Once that's out, she'll grant Alessandra forgiveness. But when Edie pulls into the driveway, she finds Raoul and Alessandra loading Alessandra's Louis Vuitton duffels into the trunk of Raoul's car, and Edie forgets the anger part. Wait, she says, skidding to a stop. Raoul and Alessandra both turn to stare, but neither one of them says a word. Finally, Raoul checks his watch. I need to get to work. I'm already late, and we all know I'll hear it from Adam. He looks at Alessandra. Am I taking you to the boat?
I talked to Mrs. Bick, Edie says. It's fine. You don't have to leave. She isn't going to say anything to Lisbeth. She just wants you to back off.
Raoul's expression remains impassive, and Edie wonders if she's creating a big, dramatic Real Housewives moment, but even if she is, Raoul won't tell anyone. He's a vault. Alessandra nods at Raoul.
You go to work. I'll stay and talk to Edie.
Your boat, Raoul says.
I'll change it, Alessandra says.
Alessandra leaves her duffels on the front porch and leads Edie inside, which is its own kind of jackpot because who doesn't want to see the place where her co-workers live, especially when it's 23 Hooper Farm Road? According to Edie's mother, this house has been the rental for a colorful cast of Nantucket characters over the years. For a number of summers, servers from the Blue Bistro lived here, and after that, a group of pilots for Cape Air. And after that, girls who worked on a high-end landscaping crew, one of whom was dating the bassist for the Dropkick Murphys. But if Edie is expecting holes punched in the walls by jealous boyfriends or scorch marks from a fondue party gone bad, she's disappointed. The living room is dominated by Raoul's workout equipment, the kitchen has a peeling linoleum floor, and there's a short, dim hallway that must lead to the bedrooms. Alessandra takes Edie out the back door to a secluded yard where the kitchen table sits atop a lawn that has just been cut, probably by Raoul. There are white fairy lights strung through the overarching branches of a big shade tree. Alessandra takes a seat at the table, and Edie sits next to her thinking, I'm going to have to beg her to stay, and how twisted is that? You blackmailed that woman's husband, Edie says. She's proud of herself for not completely buckling. I did, Alessandra says. In my defense, and honestly, Edie, there is no defense for what I did. Michael told me he and his wife were taking time apart, so I thought it was open season. She shakes her head. I figured out he was lying pretty much right away, but that was his sin, not mine. And then, when his wife was about to arrive for the summer, I had bargaining power, and I cashed in on it. Edie blinks. And then you planted stuff from the neighbor's house? Alessandra sighs. I did. At that point, it was like a game. I took her eyeshadow, her shoes. That was probably good enough. I knew Michael would never realize that his wife wore Bobby Brown and the neighbor wore Chanel, or that his wife wore a size 8 and the neighbor a size 6. But then I found a positive pregnancy test in their bathroom trash, so I threw that gasoline on the fire. Gah! Alessandra touches Edie's arm. This is why I didn't want us to be friends. I'm a horrible person. I'm ruined and rotten straight through. Now it makes sense. Edie should not be friends with Alessandra. She should not look up to her at all. But even now, at this low moment, Alessandra has effortless style. Her hair is back in a ponytail. Her makeup from that morning has faded. The eye crystals have fallen off, but even so, she looks chic in a pair of faded jeans, an old Dave Matthews t-shirt, the Shoreline Amphitheater, 2000, before Edie was even born, and the one gold bangle Edie knows will never come off, the Cartier love bracelet. Someone had once cared enough about Alessandra to give her that. Then I started sleeping with guests at the hotel in exchange for them mentioning me in their reviews. Alessandra leans forward and slaps her palms on the table. That's how I won the $4,000. I prostituted myself for it. I was trying to get the money, and I only stopped because...
Because you realized someone else should have a chance to win the money?
Alessandra scoffs. No. I stopped because of that douchebag with the Corvette Stingray in 310. Remember him?
Ugh, Edie says, yes.
He took me to dinner at Topper's, Alessandra says. Talked all about himself, but whatever. I wasn't there for the conversation. Then when we got back to the hotel, he shoved me onto the bed, ripped up my dress, and pinned me down. He would have raped me if I hadn't thrown him off.
Oh my God, Edie says. I can't believe you threw him off you. That dude was all muscle.
As bad as that experience was, it was also a wake-up call. I stopped targeting men and just focused on doing my job. She pauses. But then when Xavier showed up, I thought, he's wealthy and single. Why not go after him?
Ew, Edie says. He's like 70 years old.
Didn't matter. He wasn't interested in me. So I texted Michael those photos I'd been saving in case of emergency. She gives Edie a direct gaze. I wouldn't blame you if you never spoke to me again. I knew you'd been on the other side of that, and I did it anyway.
Yeah,
Edie whispers. I didn't have parents like yours growing up, Alessandra says, parents who led by example and showed me how to do things correctly. I didn't grow up in a nurturing community where everyone called me sweet Alessandra and had my back. I mean, that's no excuse. I know right from wrong, and I consistently choose wrong. Heidi Bick should press charges. She should want to see me fired.
She's not doing any of that, Edie says, as long as you stay away from them.
I will, Alessandra says. She gives Edie a weary smile. Sometimes I wish men weren't so predictable. It's this statement more than anything else that illustrates their age difference, Edie thinks. Men are predictable to Alessandra, but to Edie, they're still a mystery.
I want you to stay, Edie says. I'm upset about what you did, but I can't bear to think of finishing up the season without you. Who would I complain to about Mr. Iannucci?
Iannucci, Alessandra says. I'm telling you, that guy's a cop. Edie grins.
I thought he was Shelley Carpenter.
The post comes out tomorrow.
Another reason why you have to stay, Edie says. You have to.
Okay, Alessandra says. Her eyes mist up. Thank you for, I don't know, showing up here, being tough but cool. The corners of her mouth lift a bit. I raised you well. Edie pulls the manila envelope out of her backpack.
I'm giving you your money back, by the way.
No, Alessandra says. I cheated. It's yours.
You're great on the desk, Edie says. It's yours.
I'm not taking it back, Edie. I don't deserve it. Edie pulls the cash out and riffles the bills.
How about we split it, then?
Alessandra releases a breath. Fine. Fine. Edie counts out $2,000 and slides it toward her friend. She thinks about her little spy club with Zeke and wonders if she has any obligation to tell him about this. She decides not. It's a desk thing. Chapter 25. The Last Friday of the Month. August. Lisbeth and Edie are in Lisbeth's office at 11:58, and at 11:59, Lisbeth taps on her Instagram icon. As soon as her phone says noon, she visits the hotel confidential account and refreshes, but all she sees is the review from the Sea Castle Bed and Breakfast in Hyannisport.
Come on, Shelley,
Lisbeth says. She turns to Edie.
Has she ever been late before? Hit refresh again, Edie says.
Lisbeth inhales, then hits the refresh button. On her screen is a picture of Zeke and Adam, framed inside the grand front doors, both of them waving and smiling. Lisbeth sees the potted flowers on the steps and one wide rocker and fireplace table on the front porch. She blinks. This is real? This is their hotel? Those are their bellmen? Because it feels like a figment of Lisbeth's imagination, a manifestation. Edie, who is holding her own phone, shrieks, and Lisbeth reads the caption. She leaps out of her chair and grabs Edie, and the two of them dance around the office. Lisbeth's eyes blur with tears. She can't believe it, and yet she knew they would do it. In her heart, she knew. She used to think that meeting JJ and running the deck was her dream come true, but no, it's this. This is what she was meant to do.
We did it, Edie shouts. We did it.
Adam and Zeke come running in. Adam is on the phone with Raoul, who has just seen the review at home. Alessandra slips in, and Lisbeth gives her a hug, because any way you look at it, they couldn't have gotten 5 keys without her. Lisbeth texts Mario, 5 keys! Adam says, has anyone read the actual review yet?
No, Edie says. Let's all do it at the same time. 1, 2, 3.
Wait, I'm not ready, Adam says. He scrolls. Okay, go.
They click on the link in bio. Hotel Confidential by Shelley Carpenter. August 26th, 2022. The Hotel Nantucket, Nantucket, Massachusetts. 5 keys. Hello, friends. I've been reviewing hotel experiences for nearly 15 years, and never once have I been tempted to use the word best. It's not an appropriate qualifier for a hotel. How can one compare the Siam in Bangkok to Auberge du Soleil in Napa, to the Dulini River Lodge in South Africa? The answer is one can't. Though all exquisite, they're different species. However, after a recent visit to the Hotel Nantucket, I find myself struggling for a word other than best. I have, for the first time, awarded a property 5 keys, and there's no doubt in my mind that this coveted 5th key is well-deserved. The Hotel Nantucket, originally built in 1910, has survived a fire, financial difficulties, and owners with poor taste. It fell into severe disrepair and sat on the market for over 10 years until it was purchased by London billionaire Xavier Darling. As you know, friends, the most important quality for me in any hotel is a sense of place. Unlike the 3 other luxury properties on Nantucket, the White Elephant, the Nantucket Beach Club and Hotel, and the Walwinet, the Hotel Nantucket isn't located on the water. It claims a full block of Easton Street, which is easy walking distance from the cobblestoned streets of Nantucket's downtown. The lobby is a large, airy room that blends historical elements, the building's original oak beams, an authentic whaleboat that serves as a chandelier, with modern, comfy chairs, ottomans, tables laden with books and games. Unlike some other lobbies I've visited, the lobby of the Hotel Nantucket is one people gravitate to. The hotel's simple but extraordinary continental breakfast is served here every morning between 7 and 10:30. Don't miss the percolated coffee or the almond croissants. And while I was in residence, a young chess prodigy played with any guest brave enough to challenge him. Often a crowd gathered. The magnanimity that was extended to me throughout my stay began at check-in. I was upgraded to one of the hotel's exquisite suites for the price of a standard street view room. The living area of the suite included a library wall that was lined with books, a mixture of current bestsellers, with a whole shelf dedicated to beach reads, and classics. There was a cushioned window seat wide and long enough to actually accommodate a reclining adult human. So often, I feel that window seats are only for show. Also in the living area was the complimentary minibar. That's right, friends, I said complimentary. The minibar was stocked with local beer, wine, and spirits, smoked bluefish pate and guacamole from local fishmonger 167 Raw, and packages of crackers and chips, gluten-free crackers available upon request. The master bedroom featured the largest bed I have ever slept in. It's a custom size called Emperor. The bed was sheathed in Matuk linens, my preferred brand, as you know, and topped with a cashmere blanket from local weaver Nantucket Looms. The ceiling of the room was hand-painted with the Nantucket night sky by Tamala Cornejo, which was a particularly appropriate touch, since Nantucket is the birthplace of noted female astronomer Maria Mitchell. The bathroom was the platonic ideal, spacious, luxurious, well-appointed. The shower was tiled with oyster shells. The lighting over the sink made my skin look as dewy as Anne Hathaway's in The Princess Diaries. Am I aging myself? And there was a separate water closet, which I always prefer. The hotel featured a wellness center, which, I will not lie, friends, I did not visit after my initial inspection, though other guests gushed about the gym, sauna, and the yoga studio, and 2 glorious pools, one a joyous hive of activity for families, and one a serene refuge for adults only. Friends, I am officially over my word limit, but I refuse to stop because the best is yet to come. The hotel's restaurant, the Blue Bar, was the brainchild of Chef Mario Subiaco. I don't have space to list his accolades. Google him. The Blue Bar offered an experience unlike any other on Nantucket. It feels like walking into a swanky A-list party you can't believe you've been invited to. The cocktails were made with top-shelf liquor. The fare was fun-loving, pigs in a blanket, a little retro, church picnic deviled eggs, and a little decadent, luscious caviar sandwiches. All meals end with a visit from the whipped cream concierge, vegan whipped cream available upon request. A copper disco ball dropped at 9 o'clock, and the music switched to 80s dance hits. The best part of the Hotel Nantucket wasn't the conviviality in the lobby, or the expansive real estate of the bed, or the festive atmosphere of the Blue Bar. The best part of the Hotel Nantucket was the staff. It may have taken me 15 years to realize this, friends, but realize it I have. Hotels aren't about rooms. They aren't about amenities. They're about people. And the people who work at the Hotel Nantucket are what earned the property its fifth key. The front desk clerks, the bellman, the night auditor, the housekeeping crew, and the general manager, Lisbeth Keaton, were attentive. They listened. They were friendly. They were helpful. They were knowledgeable. And above all, they were kind. Some of you might be wondering if I'm going to address the elephant in the room. Is the Hotel Nantucket, as reported by the AP, the Washington Post, and USA Today, haunted by the ghost of Grace Hadley, a chambermaid who was killed in a fire in 1922? I don't believe in ghosts, or I didn't before my stay at the Hotel Nantucket. During my stay, I heard tales of flickering lights, music blaring out of nowhere, the electric shades going haywire. None of those stories persuaded me. However, I did feel a watchful, even nurturing presence throughout my stay. It's my unshakable opinion that Grace Hadley makes most of the hotel's guests, including yours truly, feel safe, and yes, even loved. But, as with any strong woman, I wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of her. I'm sure some of you have already predicted what I'm going to say next. This will be my final Hotel Confidential post. Some of you might suspect that I'm stopping because I have finally found perfection, my Shangri-La, and there may be some truth to that. Any property I visited after such a transformative experience would no doubt be a letdown. But the bigger and more important reason I'm retiring from this particular endeavor is because I want more time to stay home and take care of my children. Surprise! I have two children, and a dog as well. I'd like to thank you, friends, for accompanying me on my journeys around the world. While hotel reviewing can be lonely, traveling solo and undercover, unable to share my true identity or life's details with anyone I met, I always felt that you, my readers, were with me. And you haven't seen the last of Shelley Carpenter. I'm starting a new blog about finding love after a marriage falls apart. I'm calling it The Second Story. Stay well, friends, and do good. S.C. Lisbeth chokes up when she reads the adjectives Shelley used to describe the staff. Attentive, friendly, helpful, knowledgeable, kind. Edie sniffles, and Zeke plucks a tissue for her from the box on Lisbeth's desk. Attentive, Lisbeth thinks, and kind. Then she reads the section about the ghost, Grace Hadley, and while a part of Lisbeth thinks, just what we need, more guests showing up expecting a haunting, she realizes that what Shelley says is true. Grace Hadley has been looking out for them all. Next, Lisbeth reads the shocking news of Shelley's retirement. What? Edie says. Shelley Carpenter is staying home with her two children and her dog? And her dog, Zeke says. Lots of people have two kids and a dog, Adam says. The whole world has two kids and a dog. Then Lisbeth reads about Shelley Carpenter starting a new blog. About finding love after a marriage falls apart, Adam reads over Lisbeth's shoulder. He honks out a laugh. It is Kimber. Kimber is Shelley Carpenter. At that second, the door to Lisbeth's office opens and Richie steps in. Edie says, we got five keys, Richie, did you see? Then she gasps. Did you know? Did you know Kimber is Shelley Carpenter?
I found out the night before she left, Richie says. Kimber didn't want to tell me until after the review was sent in. She's a professional.
At that second, there's a buzzing noise, and Richie pulls his cell phone out of his pocket.
Hey, Boo, he says.
Yep, they figured it out. We're all in Lisbeth's office.
He pauses.
Aw, okay, I'll tell them. Love you.
Richie hangs up and gives them a sad smile.
She says she misses you already.
August 28th, 2022. From Xavier Darling, xd@darlingent.com.uk. To
employees of the Hotel Nantucket.
It was a pleasure and a privilege to meet you all in person this past week. I'm only sorry I couldn't stay longer. Congratulations are in order for the fifth key from Shelley Carpenter of Hotel Confidential. Hear, hear. Shelley has been a formidable critic of hotels and resort properties across the globe, and it was my not-so-secret goal to win the fifth key. But ultimately it was you, the staff, who impressed Ms. Carpenter the most. I will be including a $1,000 bonus in everyone's check this week. Unfortunately, I must follow this up with some rather somber news. I am putting the Hotel Nantucket on the market, effective tomorrow. I have already received an offer on the place from a friend and colleague who wants to use the building as a satellite office space. This means that, unless another buyer comes forward with a competitive offer, the Hotel Nantucket will no longer operate as a hotel. I thank you all for your time, energy, expertise, and dedication this summer. Every one of you should feel free to call on me for a letter of recommendation as you move forward into your various futures. All best, XD. An email from Xavier arrives in Lisbeth's inbox at 5 o'clock on Sunday evening, and Lisbeth nearly ignores it because she's exhausted from the excitement of the past week. She wants to pick up a pizza from Pi, draw a bath, and then climb into bed to watch Ted Lasso until Mario gets finished with work. But it's Xavier, so she can't wait until the morning. Putting the hotel on the market. Use the building as a satellite office space? She feels like she's reading her own obituary. Edie cracks open the door and says, "Lisbeth, did you see? I... Lisbeth doesn't have words. For the past 2 days, she has been floating. Everyone on the island has reached out, calling, texting, messaging on Facebook and Instagram to congratulate her and the rest of the staff on the fifth key from Shelley Carpenter. JJ sent a bouquet, the first flowers from him she hasn't sent back in a year. Lisbeth's parents called from Minnetonka. She's heard from countless news outlets, including the New York Times, Travel and Leisure, CBS Sunday Morning, Afar, the Armchair Explorer podcast, wanting to do interviews, articles, segments. But most meaningfully, Lisbeth heard from her old dorm mate, Elise Perivale, who was the reason Lisbeth came to Nantucket in the first place. Elise wrote that her family had, sadly, sold their house on the island, but that she would like to book rooms at the Hotel Nantucket the following summer for 2 weeks. Lisbeth had wanted to talk to Xavier about raising their prices ever so slightly, because the phone has been ringing nonstop the past 2 days. At this rate, the hotel would be completely booked with a waiting list for next summer by Labor Day. You don't sell a hotel when the entire next season is booked, Lisbeth thinks. Did Xavier not even glance at the financials? The business is booming. And now that they have the fifth key and all this media attention, they should be moving full steam ahead. Lisbeth dreams of refurbishing the fourth floor and adding more rooms, and maybe also extending their season through Christmas stroll. She'd love to create a sunset viewing platform on the Widow's Walk, maybe hire Adam as their full-time lobby entertainment, creating a little competition for the club car piano bar. Their Instagram could use some beefing up. She could give Edie a side hustle of being their social media manager. There are so many things. They're just getting started.
He's selling it, Edie says. He already has a buyer.
Lisbeth gives Edie a wink. He must be cranky about something else, she says. This isn't real. He won't sell.
He won't?
Let me talk to him, Lisbeth says. As Lisbeth dials Xavier, she wonders again if something happened while he was here. He left so early, so quickly, without saying goodbye. Maybe it was business, but Lisbeth's gut tells her it was something else. The call goes straight to voicemail. It is 11 o'clock on a Sunday night in London, but Xavier sent the email only 10 minutes ago. Surely he's still awake. She calls again from her phone. Voicemail. She sends him a text, something she has never done before. It has always seemed too casual, too familiar, but this is an emergency. Xavier, can we please talk about your email tonight? I'm not sure I'll sleep otherwise.
She stares at her phone, trying to manifest a response. Sure enough, three dots rise on Xavier's side of the chat. What is he going to say? She needs to talk to him, ask him what happened. Wasn't any negative experience he might have had while at the hotel washed away by Shelley's five-key review? The dots disappear, but no text comes through. Lisbeth checks her email. Nothing. He doesn't want to talk to her. It's this that fills her with a hot, loose, watery panic. She runs into the Blue Bar kitchen, even though the bar is filling up with guests and Mario has started service. She catches a glimpse of him, gorgeous as ever in his white chef's jacket, houndstooth pants, and white sox cap, at the pass inspecting the plates, and she fully expects him to tell her to leave. She's never interrupted him at work before. But instead, he steps away and says, "Beatrice, cover for me, please. I need a minute." He takes Lisbeth by the hand, and they step into the quieter service kitchen where a huge bowl of dough is proofing. Beatrice's croissants for the next morning. "You heard?" Lisbeth says.
"He did just what I was afraid he'd do," Mario says. "Pulled the plug."
"But why?" Lisbeth says. "Doesn't he realize how great everything is?"
"He got what he wanted," Mario says. "The fifth key. Guys like Xavier aren't in this for the money or the greater good. Restoring an historic building, boosting the local economy, creating jobs. They're in it for the bragging rights. He probably bet some guy he met at Annabelle's that he could buy a hotel and get the fifth key. And he did. And now he has no use for it anymore."
Lisbeth wants to feel angry, but she's too tired. So what overcomes her is grief. She cries against the front of Mario's pristine white jacket, and he holds her tight, rubbing her back.
"It'll be okay. We'll go to California. You can work at a hotel there. I know the GM at Shutters. You'll like that, on the beach in Santa Monica."
"I don't want to work at someone else's hotel," Lisbeth says. Does she sound childish? Probably. But she can't imagine getting a job in Los Angeles. She also can't fathom finding another position here on the island. She made one monumental change, successfully, but she can't turn around and do it again.
"We'll figure it out together, okay?"
Mario says. He eases her off him so he can look her in the eye.
"You aren't alone anymore. I'm here, and I'm out of a job too."
"We need to make Xavier change his mind." Mario sighs.
"He isn't going to change his mind, Lisbeth."
Suddenly, Zeke comes charging into the kitchen, and his presence is so startling that Lisbeth thinks Xavier must be on the phone. He called back. He's willing to talk.
Zeke says, "Lisbeth, we need you in the lobby. Stuff is going down."
Stuff is going down. When Lisbeth gets back to the lobby, she sees Richie with three gentlemen in suits, one of whom is handcuffing him. "Wait," Lisbeth cries out. Her head feels like it's going to topple off her body. "What's going on?"
"Mr. Decameron is under arrest for wire fraud,"
one of the gentlemen who's not cuffing Richie says. He holds up a badge.
"Agent Iannucci, FBI.
Lisbeth blinks. Mr. Iannucci, formerly of Room 307. "Richie?" she says. Richie hangs his head.
"I'm sorry, Lisbeth."
Chapter 26. The Cobblestone Telegraph. On Sunday evening, Fast Eddie heads into his real estate office on Main Street to type up the listing sheet for the Hotel Nantucket. He received a call from Xavier Darling earlier that afternoon. Xavier wants to sell pronto. He's already gotten an offer from a colleague in London who wants to convert the hotel into an office building, but this colleague is holding firm at $16 million.
"Listed at 20," Xavier told Eddie, "but between us, I'll take 22.
"You put 30 into it," Eddie said. "32 if you count what you paid for it."
"I need to take it as a loss this year," Xavier said, "though not too much of a loss."
Eddie puts the listing on his website at 7 p.m. Xavier informed Lisbeth and the rest of the hotel staff of his intent to sell at 5 p.m.
Poor Lisbeth, Eddie thinks. She poured her heart and soul into that place and turned it into a genuine phoenix risen from the ashes success story. She has such a magic touch that Eddie decides he'll offer her a job as a sales associate with Bayberry Properties and sponsor her classes. Eddie then pops into Ventuno for a celebratory cocktail. He tells the bartender, Johnny B., that he's relisting the Hotel Nantucket for $25 million. Those of us who overhear this tidbit note the barely suppressed glee in Eddie's voice. He's looking at quite a commission, especially if he comes up with the buyer. One of the people who is sitting at the Ventuno bar within earshot of Eddie is Charlene, the nurse from Our Island Home. Charlene is drowning her sorrows because her favorite resident, Mint Benedict, has contracted pneumonia, and the doctors say he's not likely to make it through the week. The next morning, when Charlene goes to visit Mint at the Nantucket Cottage Hospital, Mint asks her to collect everything from his safety deposit box at Nantucket Bank.
"There's some of my mother's jewelry that I want you to have," Mint says, his voice broken and gravelly. "And there are papers I'd like you to go through. Letters and my father's journal."
Charlene pats Mint's hand, which is burning up despite the intravenous antibiotics.
"I'll bring it all here and we can go through it together. How about that?"
She considers telling Mint what she overheard about the Hotel Nantucket going on the market again, but she isn't sure if this will make him feel better. He was right. The place does seem to be cursed, or if it will send him into a downward spiral. She decides to keep the news to herself. Jordan Randolph at the Nantucket Standard notices the new real estate listing right away. He calls Lisbeth to find out what's going on, but Lisbeth isn't available for comment. Jordan then hears about an FBI sting at the hotel, and he immediately contacts the Nantucket Police Department to see what Chief Ed Kapanash knows about it.
"Wire fraud," Ed says.
Ed is a gruff fellow on a good day, but tonight he sounds particularly worn out. Jordan empathizes. It's the end of a long, hot summer, and everyone on this island is in need of a 3-day nap.
"Their night auditor was selling people's credit card numbers, addresses, and driver's license information. He was doing a brisk business in stolen identities."
"Wow," Jordan says.
"Apparently, the feds have been watching him for a while. He did some small-time embezzling at an insurance company in Connecticut, wiring his child support payments out of their payroll account. The company didn't press charges because he'd been there so long and the ex-wife had really stuck it to him in the divorce. Then he hooked up with one of those sneaker brokers and that guy got busted for tax evasion. And I guess DeCameron knew about it and was accepting cash to keep quiet."
"And Lisbeth gave him a job anyway?" Jordan says.
"I'm sure she was desperate for the help," the chief says. "She hired some guy who presented well, but who ended up being in over his head."
He pauses.
"Some days I feel like that guy."
"Yeah," Jordan says.
"Me too."
And the conversation ends on a laugh. Blonde Sharon can't believe her good luck. The Hotel Nantucket is at the center of all this gossip at the same time that her sister, Heather, checks in for a week-long stay. Sharon picks up Heather, who is brunette, from the airport, drives her to the hotel, and accompanies her inside under the guise of getting her settled. But really, Sharon wants to find out what precisely is going on. She passes sweet Edie Robbins on the front steps. Edie waves and says she's going to lunch, but that Alessandra will be happy to check Heather in. Bingo, Sharon thinks. Alessandra is one of the people Sharon wants to see, because Alessandra is reputedly the woman who slept with Michael Bick, then made everyone think it was Lyric Layton. Sharon is expecting a villainess from a James Bond film, and while she's not disappointed by Alessandra's appearance, she's a stunner with wavy strawberry blonde hair and stylish makeup. She's wearing white eyeliner, and Sharon wonders if she could get away with that or if she's 25 years too old. And what about eye crystals? Alessandra isn't the evil bitch that Sharon expects. She's warm and genuine, as well as incredibly helpful and organized.
She prints a list of all of Heather and Sharon's dinner reservations, and she has somehow managed to score the two of them a tea time for the next day at Maya Comet Golf Club, which is basically impossible because everyone knows there's a top-secret list of preferred clients even though the course is public. Well done, Alessandra, Sharon thinks.
Is Lisbeth around by any chance? Sharon asks.
Let me see if she's available, Alessandra says. A second later, Lisbeth emerges from the back office looking as fabulous as ever in a black linen sheath with peekaboo cutouts at the waist and a cute belt.
Is the black because you're in mourning? Sharon asks. I hear the hotel is being sold.
I'm optimistic that whoever buys it will keep it the way it is, so we'll all have our jobs next summer. Sharon says.
Not to be Gertie Gloom, but I heard there was a buyer already who wants to turn it into a corporate headquarters.
Lisbeth purses her lips.
Sharon, she chides, you know better than to spread rumors. I have a good source.
Well then, I suppose I'll be moving to L.A., Lisbeth says. Sharon is rendered temporarily speechless. Nobody on this island wants to see Lisbeth move away.
What happened to your night manager? Sharon asks. I heard the FBI arrested him.
Lisbeth smiles without showing any teeth. Sharon isn't without self-awareness. She knows she's pushing it with this question.
Richie is a very sweet man, Lisbeth says. However, Love Robbins will be on the night desk until we close.
Sharon reaches out a hand.
We're all wishing you well, sweetie pie.
And it's true. We all are. It's one of the few things we can agree on. After watching the unlikely blossoming of the Hotel Nantucket over the summer, we want to see it succeed. But we have to admit, it's not looking good. Chapter 27. Long Shot. At 8 o'clock Monday night, there's a knock on the front door. Chad is up in his room playing Madden NFL, though he's supposed to be getting a head start on his packing. His job at the Brandywine Group starts the Tuesday after Labor Day. After his drink date with Ms. English the previous Wednesday, Chad marched into his house and invited his mother, father, and Leith into the formal living room. They complied, probably only because it was such an unusual request. They never used the formal living room. Chad had some things he wanted to say.
First of all, I'd like to apologize. I'm to blame for Patty losing an eye, for Lulu's death, and for all of the damage done to our house.
Chaddy, his mother said, I thought we agreed to move on.
Chad ignores this predictable response.
I got a job at the Hotel Nantucket because I wanted a summer of honest work. I didn't want to teach little kids to chip and putt. I wanted to do something difficult, unpleasant even.
Chad paused.
I didn't take the job to make you proud of me. I did it for myself. But even so, I'm surprised that you don't seem to find my decision laudable.
You're using some good SAT words there, bruh, Leith says.
You seemed embarrassed that I was cleaning rooms, Chad said to his parents. You never refer to my job, never talk about it, never ask how my day was.
It isn't what Mom and I wanted for you, Paul Winslow said. We wanted you to be able to recharge your batteries before coming to join me at the firm.
About that, Chad said, I won't be joining you at the firm.
Chad's mother shrieked as though she'd seen a rat hiding beneath her prized Edra sofa.
Leith said, This is getting good.
I like working at the hotel, Chad said. I want to stay in hospitality. Maybe go back to school and get into a management program.
Paul kept his cool because keeping his cool was his job.
Our administrative assistants make over $200,000 a year, he said, which is more than double what you'll be making as a manager at the Holiday Inn.
I don't care about money, Chad said.
That's easy for you to say. You've always had it. You don't know the first thing about being poor or even middle class, Chadwick. You've never had to pay for a single thing in all your life.
I know that money doesn't make you happy, Chad said. I mean, look at the three of you.
With that, Chad stomped upstairs to his room, high on his own righteousness.
He would stay on Nantucket through Columbus Day, and he would get into some kind of hotel management program. He would work at the Hotel Nantucket the following year, even if it meant cleaning rooms again, though he hoped he could secure a job on the desk. He wondered what Ms. English would think of this. But now, only 5 days later, everything has changed. The first thing Chad heard was that Richie DeCameron, the night auditor, got arrested for selling guests' credit card numbers. This had actually been sort of good news as far as Chad was concerned, though he'd never admit this to anyone, because the position of night auditor was one Chad might be able to fill the following year. Then Chad learned that Xavier Darling was putting the hotel on the market. He was going to sell it, and it might not be a hotel at all next year. And so, Chad is back to facing a future at his father's firm. He's playing video games because it's a way to avoid preparing for a life he doesn't want to live. When he hears the knock on the front door, he jumps to his feet. He fears it's one of his former friends trying to lure him out just once before the summer ends, because who else could it be? Chad peers out the window and sees the gunmetal gray Jeep Gladiator that Ms. English drives.
Whoa,
Chad thinks. He runs down the stairs, opens the front door, and sure enough, there's Ms. English standing on his porch. She smiles at him.
Hello there, Longshot.
Ms. English, he says.
Ms. English is here, on Eel Point Road? Chad then recalls seeing her down the street at number 133 back in the middle of the summer. He'd never mentioned seeing her because he didn't want her to know that he knew she cleaned other houses. A chilling thought comes to him. Ms. English is here tonight to see if she can clean for his family. Now that the hotel is closing, she must need a job. Chad feels mortified by what Ms. English has already seen. The long, white-shell driveway lined on either side by pruned boxwood, the hydrangea bushes showboating along the front porch, and the needlessly enormous waterfront home behind him.
Is your father at home? Ms. English asks.
My father?
Yes, Ms. English says.
Her outfit falls somewhere between what she normally wears to work and what she wore to drinks the other evening. She has on white pants and a navy tunic printed with white hibiscus. Her hair is in corkscrew curls to her shoulders, and she's wearing pearl earrings.
He's expecting me.
He is? Chad says.
And at that second, Paul Winslow strides out from the back of the house.
Magda, hello,
he says. And Chad nearly falls through the floor. His father knows Ms. English? Chad experiences a moment of vertigo as he wonders if maybe this whole summer has been a setup. Has Paul Winslow been pulling the puppet strings all along? Did his father want him to be working at the hotel to teach him the lessons that he thought he'd learned on his own?
I went out today and got a bottle of Appleton Estate 21, Paul says, just to have it on hand for you. Can I pour you a glass?
I'd love it, Paul, thank you, Magda says.
Paul claps Chad on the shoulder.
Show Magda to my study, please, bud. I'll be back in a second with the drinks.
Paul heads to the kitchen, and Chad stares at Ms. English for a second. Is this another one of those moments, like when she told him what happened to Bibi, where nothing is what it seems? Maybe Paul is interviewing Magda, not for a job cleaning their house, but for a job at the Brandywine Group. If Ms. English works there, will that make Chad's position there any more palatable? No, Chad thinks, not really.
The study, Longshot? She says.
Oh, right.
Chad shows Ms. English into the study. She sits in one of the butterscotch suede club chairs and crosses her legs. She pulls her phone and a legal pad out of her bag.
Okay, Chad says. I'll see you tomorrow morning.
Don't you want to stay? Ms. English asks.
Stay? Chad says. If you don't mind my asking, what's going on? Why are you here?
Ms. English laughs. Oh, Longshot, you should see your face. It's priceless. She leans forward and whispers,
Your father and I are forming a partnership. We're going to buy the hotel.
Chapter 28. The Cobblestone Telegraph.
When we next see Fast Eddie, he's seated at the big front table at Crewe, where he has ordered a magnum of Dom Perignon, which is attended by two servers and three live sparklers. Well, it's no wonder. It has taken a mere 3 days for him to secure a $20 million offer on the Hotel Nantucket. The buyer is known only as the Longshot Trust, but because Eddie can't keep his mouth shut, something his sister Barbie scolds him for nonstop, someone among us discovered that the property was purchased in equal parts by two entities. One was Paul Winslow, a principal at the Brandywine Group who owns a home on Eel Point Road, and the other was Magda English, the head of housekeeping at the Hotel Nantucket.
"I knew Magda was hiding something," Nancy Twine of the Summer Street Church said. "I used to wonder about her putting so much in the collection plate on Sundays, and now I find out she could have put in 10 times more. She has millions."
Yes, Magda English's net worth hovers around $24 million. The unconfirmed story is that she caught the eye of Xavier Darling 30 years earlier when she was working on one of his cruise ships. He wined and dined her in Monte Carlo, and they ended up at a casino where she placed a $500 bet, her own money, she would be quick to point out, and rolled the dice at the craps table for nearly 2 hours, going all in each time and walking away with $215,000. She invested this money with Xavier Darling's bankers, where it grew at a steady rate. Then, in 2012, Xavier approached Magda with a dark horse opportunity. He was investing in a company that was developing a new kind of personal security software. After reading the company's prospectus, Magda told Xavier she wanted in. The company went public in July of 2021, and Magda's small fortune became a big fortune. The following month, her sister-in-law, Charlotte English, died suddenly in her sleep, and Magda moved to Nantucket to be with her brother William and her nephew Zeke. She had been looking at property with Fast Eddie, including homes on Eel Point Road, but hadn't found anything to her liking. She took the job as head of housekeeping at the hotel because she was always happiest when she was busy.
"At least that's what I've gathered from our chats," said Brian, the bartender at the Brant Point Grill. Brian was the one who'd spilled the beans about Magda and Xavier. "They were definitely having a thing," he said. "She told me he was an old friend, but I was getting a vibe of old friend with benefits."
This makes Magda's decision to buy the hotel even more intriguing. Apparently, when Eddie told her that Xavier already had a private offer of $16 million, Magda said, "I'm going to call Xavier's bluff. His friend who wants to turn the hotel into a satellite office is probably only half serious. Who puts a satellite office 30 miles out to sea? But my partner and I will give Xavier the benefit of the doubt and offer $18 million.
He'll close at 20.
"Done," Magda said. As for Magda's partner, Paul Winslow, he was overheard saying,
"I'm sure I'll be accused of buying the hotel for my son, but in reality, I was presented with a smart business proposition by Magda English. The Hotel Nantucket is a piece of Nantucket history, but it's also poised to be the most gracious accommodations on this island for generations to come. Who wouldn't want to be a part of that, given the choice? As for my son, Chad, I hope this deal shows him firsthand what kind of positive opportunities my firm can create. I hope he ultimately decides to come work with me. But if he stays on at the hotel, I respect that decision. The important thing is that the Hotel Nantucket is back in business."
Charlene from Our Island Home senses an exuberance in the hotel staff the moment she steps into the lobby. The air is rich with the smell of good coffee and fresh baked pastry. Aretha Franklin is asking for a little respect. The place is buzzing with conversation and laughter. Charlene feels like a bit of a bubble burster. She has come to the hotel on a sobering mission. She approaches the desk where sweet Edie Robbins is working. Charlene has known Edie since the days her father, Vance, used to carry her in the baby Bjorn at the Stop and Shop, though now Edie is all grown up, looking quite chic in her silky hydrangea blue blouse. Charlene says, "Good morning, Edie.
I can see you're busy, but do you have a minute to talk?
Of course, Charlene, Edie says.
She turns to her coworker, a woman with lovely long gingery hair, and says,
I'll be back shortly.
Edie leads Charlene through a closed door into the employee break room. Charlene has heard rumors about this room, and it doesn't disappoint. There's a Formica bar counter with bright orange leather and chrome diner stools, a jukebox, a pinball machine, and a curvy mid-century sofa where Edie leads them to sit.
I only have a few minutes, Edie says.
Yes, Charlene says. You must be wondering what I'm doing here. She pulls a plastic bag from her purse, and from the bag, she removes an old leather-bound journal with the initials JFB in gold leaf on the cover.
I'm sad to say that Mint Benedict passed away yesterday.
Edie blinks.
I'm sorry, I don't know who that is. He was one of your residents? He was elderly?
94, Charlene says. He was the only child of Jackson and Dahlia Benedict. Edie smiles politely.
I'm still not sure. They owned the hotel from 1910 to 1922, Charlene says. Then there was a fire and a chambermaid was killed.
Our ghost, Edie says.
Your ghost.
Charlene hands Edie the journal. This is Jackson Benedict's diary from that year. Mint kept it in his safety deposit box. Mint's mother, Dahlia, died of alcoholism when Mint was only 10 years old, and Jackson passed from cancer in 1943. There are also photographs and some small items from the hotel, a handbell, a few keys, some pieces of china from the ballroom. Mint is donating those to the Nantucket Historical Association, but he wants you here at the hotel to have Jackson's diary. He made it clear he would like someone to actually read it.
I'll read it, Edie says, but I can't do it right now. I have to get back to work.
Just promise you'll...
Yes, of course, Edie says. I'm pumped about this.
She opens the journal's cover and sees the first page is dated August 22, 1922.
This is the hotel's history.
I have to admit, I read it myself, Charlene says. It reveals some secrets about this place. The literal skeletons in the closet.
You should probably read it first, Edie says to Lisbeth,
sliding Jackson Benedict's diary across Lisbeth's desk.
Charlene gave it to you, Lisbeth says. I'm not sure I can get to it tonight, Edie says. I'm going to dinner with Zeke.
What? Lisbeth says. Is this hotel responsible for another romance? Edie shrugs.
We're just going out to celebrate the hotel purchase.
She lowers her voice.
Zeke had no idea his aunt had that much money. He and his dad were totally blown away.
Thank God for Magda, Lisbeth says, or I'd be working as the concierge at the Peninsula in Beverly Hills. Alessandra steps into the office. The concierge at the Peninsula in Beverly Hills, she says. That's the job I'm applying for.
I know, Lisbeth says. They called me today for a reference.
And? Alessandra says.
I predict that next summer you'll be back on the West Coast.
Where I belong, Alessandra says.
Yes, Edie thinks.
She'll miss Alessandra, but she's excited about taking over as front desk manager.
I hope the men in LA are ready for you, she says.
They aren't, Alessandra and Lisbeth say together.
Sit down if you have a minute, Lisbeth says. Edie is going to read to us.
August 22nd, 1922. Here, for my descendants, should I be lucky enough to have any, and for the historians and the detective inspectors, is a real and true account of the events of August 19th and 20th, 1922. I'm not a gifted writer, nor, up to this point in my life, have I been particularly introspective, but I feel I must put these words down, if only to exorcise them from my soot-stained mind. My wife, Dahlia, and I held a dinner dance in the ballroom of my hotel this past Saturday. The evening started with turtle soup, followed by beef Wellington and lobster tails, and everyone enjoyed gin cocktails and champagne. Dahlia got quite tight, as always. She flirted shamelessly with Chase Yorkbridge and asked him to escort her up to our suite as a way to make me jealous. But I was not jealous at all, only relieved. I left the party directly after Dahlia and headed up to the attic storage closet to see Grace. Grace Hadley, my mistress. I was in love with her. I am in love with her still.
Edie looks up. This is why Mint Benedict wanted us to read it. Grace Hadley was Jackson Benedict's lover.
Alessandra shrugs. I always assumed that.
You did not, Lisbeth says.
A chambermaid shacking up in the fourth floor storage closet? Alessandra says. What did you think she was doing up there?
Lisbeth waves a hand. Keep going, Edie.
When I knocked, Grace cracked open the door, cautious as always. She was afraid that one night she would find Dahlia pointing a revolver at her forehead. Grace knew Dahlia far better than I, as it turned out. When I returned from Grace's room, Dahlia was snoring and didn't stir. I figured, as I did every night I spent with Grace, that I had gotten away with something. I awoke in the middle of the night, shrouded in a thick cloud of black smoke. The chintz armchair by the window was on fire, and fire was sprinting up the drapes. I called for Dahlia. I checked her dressing chamber. She was not to be found. I stepped into the hallway to find people shouting. Leroy Noonan, the hotel's general manager, was intent on rushing me out. I was thinking only of Grace. I have to make sure she's okay, I said. Noonan, naturally, thought I was referring to Dahlia. He said, She's on the street, Mr. Benedict. Let's go now, please, sir. He hurried me toward the stairs, but I fought him, saying, I need to get to the fourth floor. The fourth floor is on fire, sir. You cannot go up there. Noonan is a big man, 6'4" and nearly 300 pounds. He could have thrown me over his shoulder and carried me out of the building. And that was what he would have to do, I decided, because I was determined to rescue Grace. I fought my way through the panicked stream of guests in their nightclothes to the bottom of the back stairway. But the entire stairwell was a fiery inferno. There would be no going up. When I reached the street, I found Dahlia looking perfectly calm amidst the pandemonium. She had her silk robe belted neatly over her dressing gown. She had on her slippers, her hair was curled, she wore lipstick, she was smoking, and she held our cat, Mittens. Something registered in me then, something I couldn't bear to think. I searched through the mob for Grace. Was she here? Had she escaped? I didn't see her. I told myself she would, naturally, be hiding because she had no good reason to be at the hotel at night. I approached the fire marshal, who assured me the fire was under control and everyone out safely. Everyone? I said. Even the people on the fourth floor? There was no one on the fourth floor, he said. We checked. He'd checked the fourth floor. Grace had escaped, and now, as I suspected, was lurking in the shadow somewhere. I returned to Dahlia's side. She said to me, The girl didn't get out. I locked her in from the outside. I grabbed Dahlia's arm. What have you done? I said. I saw the orange ember at the end of her cigarette as an evil, glowing eye. Did you set this fire, Dahlia? The cat wriggled free of Dahlia's arms and jumped to the ground, despite its bad leg. I wouldn't say that too loudly. The insurance, Jack. If there's no insurance, you'll be ruined. She put a finger across my lips. Accidents happen. I wanted to rage against her, but it only took a moment for me to realize that she was right. She had set the fire and locked Grace's door. But I was the one who had set Grace up in the attic. Kept her the same way that Dahlia kept the damn cat, possibly against her will. If Grace had defied me, I would have had no choice but to fire her and make sure she didn't find a job anywhere else on the island. I am responsible for the death of my beloved mistress, Grace Hadley. Jackson Floyd Benedict.
When Edie stops reading, a hush comes over Lisbeth's office. Finally, Alessandra speaks. What a buzzkill. No wonder Grace haunts the hotel, Lisbeth says. I would too if I were her. Edie turns the page and finds it blank.
This is the only entry in the diary, she says.
Her eyebrows shoot up.
This is all he wanted us to know.
Chapter 29. Mosaic. Grace was hanging, literally hanging, on Edie reading Jack's words, and it was even more cleansing and validating than she dreamed it might be. Dahlia set the fire. Dahlia locked the door so it wouldn't open, but Jack was correct. Ultimately, Grace's presence in that room was his fault, and Dahlia's infernal jealousy also his fault. It's a written confession, just like in the movies. Lisbeth puts the diary in the safe in her office. Tomorrow, she announces, she'll show it to Jordan Randolph at the Nantucket Standard. Grace can only hope that he'll write a follow-up article to the one published a century ago. Crime solved 100 years later. Grace Hadley murdered by hotel owners. Grace feels lighter. There's no anger weighing her down, no indignation shackling her to the hotel, no leaden angst. She's free to go to her eternal rest. She's taking the robe with her, but she leaves Lisbeth's Minnesota Twins cap on the Formica bar in the break room. Let her wander. Grace finds the hatch to the widow's walk open, and when she ascends to the fresh afternoon air, just tinged with salt, she catches Lisbeth and Mario leaning against the railing, sneaking in some kissing. Grace tests out her new buoyancy, rising above them and gazing down. It's a whole new perspective. She can see the entire hotel. Edie and Alessandra are at the front desk. Alessandra is on the phone. Edie is checking in some guests. Zeke rolls a luggage trolley by and winks at Edie. Raoul is out front at the bell desk, dealing with a guest who is checking in with an exotic bird, a hyacinth macaw. Has word gotten out that, although pets are technically forbidden at the hotel, exceptions will be made? In the yoga studio, Grace watches Yolanda lead a class of perimenopausal women in a butterfly stretch. Over at the Blue Bar, Petey Castevens is pressing fresh juices and refilling her garnishes. Beatrice is piping bechamel sauce into warm, airy gougere fresh from the oven. Octavia and Nevis are cleaning room 108, and sure enough, Nevis finds a pair of men's boxers draped over the telephone, which makes Nevis grimace and Octavia giggle. Chad and the new cleaner, Doris, are wheeling their housekeeping cart down the second floor corridor. They stop at the brass porthole windows because it's their day to be polished. Chad squirts solution onto a rag and starts buffing, and Grace thinks, "That's right, Longshot, show her how it's done." Doris isn't quite the cleaner she thinks she is. Doris says, "So, Mr. Darling put the hotel on the market because Magda turned down his proposal?" "Yes," Chad says, "but that needs to stay our secret." "And mine," Grace thinks. At that very minute, Magda is in the housekeeping office on the phone with her accountants. Edie's mother, Love, and Adam are walking up the front stairs. It's time for the shift change. "Welcome to the Hotel Nantucket," Adam sings out when he steps through the doors. Grace goes a little higher and finds she can check in on other people she knows. B.B. Evans is sitting in her criminal justice class at UMass Dartmouth. She has her hair in a cute ponytail, and tied around the elastic is what looks like a black and gold Fendi scarf. Grace gasps. It's either the scarf stolen from Mrs. Daly's suitcase, or it's a knockoff Bibi bought from a vendor on Newbury Street. Grace chooses to believe the latter. Grace ascends a little higher, and New York City comes into view. What a hive of activity! But even with all the action, Grace easily homes in on the Upper East Side. She sees Louis in a Classic Six pre-war apartment on Park Avenue. He's taking a chess lesson from a grandmaster. Grace finds Wanda walking Doug around the reservoir in Central Park. Doug is still sensitive to supernatural disturbances. He stops in his tracks and lifts his bucket head to the sky. Grace can almost read his mind. "You again? Here?" Kimber is strolling a few paces behind Wanda, talking on her phone, and Grace worries that Kimber has fallen back into her laissez-faire ways of parenting.
But then Grace realizes that Kimber is trying to retain an attorney for Richie.
Standing by her man. Grace likes it.
All of these people, her people, glitter and sparkle on their own, especially Wanda, Grace thinks, but from this distance, they also become part of a bigger whole. It's a mosaic. Maybe not as grand and celebrated as the ones Alessandra saw in Ravenna, but a work of art all the same. Grace is about to go even higher up, into the heavens, when she notices a blank spot in the mosaic, a hole, an absence. It's her space, she realizes, and now that she's risen up here, she sees it as glaringly empty. How will the hotel continue without her? She feels a strong pull downward. It's a force she can't ignore. It's love. Grace can't leave yet. Magda and Mr. Winslow are buying the hotel, and Lisbeth has a list of improvements, including refurbishing the fourth floor. How about incorporating Grace's storage closet into one of the rooms? They can call it the Grace Hadley Suite. Grace floats back down until she's hovering above the island of Nantucket, until she's directly over the hotel, until she's safely back inside. Home. Oh, fine, Grace thinks, whisking the twins' cap off the counter in the break room and fitting it snugly over her curls. I'll stay. One more year couldn't hurt.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of The Hotel Nantucket, a novel. Written by Ellen Hildebrand. Read by Aaron Bennett. Produced by Dennis Kao and Elise Green. Directed by John Kovarik. Post-production by Sean Bolter and Jeremy Wesley. The Hotel Nantucket is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2022 by Ellen Hildebrand. Audio production copyright 2022 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.